Hey folks, we had a little interruption there. I'm sorry about that issue. And we are getting ready to do the show. It was 2 days in a row now. I don't know whether it's the international Jewish media that we have to connect up through that's purposely sabotaging us or whatever, but I'm on with Dr. Patrick Slattery right now. Doctor, are you there?
I am here. I am here.
Great. Great.
Yeah, and I honestly think that the reason is that that Bill Gates, he completely genocided Skype.
It works one day and then it doesn't work. The next day it's all different.
Career.
Then the next day it's different again. It just doesn't make any sense. You know.
Yeah, he's made a career just copying what other people did well and making it suck. That's been how he became the richest man on earth.
Well,
that's
pretty authentic. Listen, we've got an interesting show today. I'm going to play you a little bit from a interview of none other than Mearsheimer, who wrote a book, of course, The Israeli Lobby, but we all know it's not the Israeli lobby, it's the Jewish lobby. The Israeli lobby is there too, of course, and Israel's one of their goals, but their goals are also economic power in the Western world, power over the American government, economic enrichment of themselves and their own ethnocentric group, and also destruction of people they see as competitors or enemies of theirs, which certainly would be included in this multipolar world because they want an America dominated by them. As you say, kind of the zombie corpse of America or of European Americans, they're riding the zombie corpse to try to control the world. But that's pretty
radical. That would be a good name for a book, don't you think? Riding the Zombie Corpse?
Maybe it's too wild. People will think it's science fiction.
Keep your eye out for it.
So I'm going to play a little thing.
That is the working title of my book.
All right, that's cool. You can use that one. So I'm going to play a little interview here with John Mearsheimer, the beginning of it, and he start talking about the conflicts. The conflicts he's talking about, let me frame this for you in the audience. He's talking about the conflicts between Russia and the EU, which is not necessary at all, and with Ukraine, by the way, which is not necessary at all, and the conflicts and America, obviously, and how this has really been directed not just by America, but by the Jewish elite. And the Jewish elite, as we point out every day, the most powerful media corporation on the planet is Alphabet. That's, for people who don't know, YouTube and Google. And Google's in multi-billion dollar contracts with Israel. It's run by racial supremacist Jews who are in billion dollar contracts with Israel, with the IDF, and they control most of the broadcast media. We just had the recent buy-ups of mass media, you know, with the guy that runs Oracle, who's a former IDF, or he's an IDF guy who sends money to the IDF who committed this genocide in Gaza. But anyway, so he's talking about that. He's talking about the conflicts in the Middle East between Iran and Lebanon and Israel and the Houthis and so forth and others in the Middle East, and how that's a big conflict too. He talks about all these things, and I want you to notice this as I play this, and I hope the audience notices it, that he's not talking about the elephant in the room, which is better described as a woolly mammoth or as a Tyrannosaurus Rex in the room of Jewish influence, because all of these conflicts have a Jewish root behind them and an ethnic root to them, the same way that Jeffrey Sachs described the fact that the Ukraine war was created by the same Jewish neocons. He names the Jewish neocons. He names them that did the Iraq war based on lies that cost mass American lives, 4.5 million lives in the Middle East. And a million human beings died because of this war based on lies, which were run by Jews. And he documents the Jews who were responsible for the Iraq war and how the same Jews, the same Jewish neocons, have now led us into this war in Ukraine, which has been more catastrophic in terms of genocide to the Ukrainian people and Russian people than even what Gaza has been to the Palestinians. And it's all horrible. So I'm going to play this for you, or at least part of it, and then we're going to dive into this. Here we go. Just a minute.
And why there's my sort of simple framework for thinking about how the world looks today. Of course, you know, up until about 2017, certainly through all of the 1990s and the first decade and a half or so of the 21st century, we lived in a unipolar world. And in that unipolar world, the United States was by definition the only great power. That world went away, in my opinion, in about 2017. And we now live in a multipolar world. And what's very important to understand about that multipolar world is that for the United States, the most important region in the world is East Asia, because China is a peer competitor in the sense that China is a rising great power and it threatens to even be more powerful than the United States. I'm not saying that will happen, but China is a formidable adversary for the United States. So you now have this multipolar world where East Asia is of paramount importance for the United States. And the United States...
Okay, let's just stop it there for a second, Doctor, and analyze this for a second. And this is great deceit. I appreciate the things that he does. He talks about this is a genocidal war in Gaza. He talks about the Jewish lobby. It was a great book on how the Jewish lobby controlled America. He never dug in that book properly to show it was Jewish billionaires who can give unlimited amounts of money. Of course, when he wrote this book, he didn't have Citizens United. But the Supreme Court decisions, which Jews definitely supported and worked for, make it possible for a Jewish billionaire, a single Jewish billionaire, single Jewish Zionist billionaire, or any other billionaire, to give unlimited amount of money to any party or any candidate or against any candidate that they choose to do that with. This is what the law states today. And of the 18 of the 20 biggest contributors for Hillary Clinton, even in that election, they were Jewish oligarchs. And since that time, we had the same thing with Biden, 8 out of 9, Kamala Harris, 9 out of 10. And we got Trump, who's got more money from the Adelsons, between $500 and $600 million over two major campaigns, at least the second two he's done. He even got a little bit in the beginning, too, his insurance policies. But he's gotten incredibly hundreds of millions of dollars from them. And he basically admitted that they bribed the crap out of him and got him to okay and accept the annexation of the Golan Heights, which is part of Syria, which where no Jews live. They have no right to steal their land. They have no right to conquer them. They have no right to take the tallest mountain in Syria. They have no right to do any of this stuff, right? And America voted in sanctions or voted for resolutions in the Security Council to not do that and to make the Jews go. They have also been ordered by resolutions, strict resolutions in the United States Security Council, the ultimate body of the United Nations, that they've got to vacate and they can't do these illegal settlements, but they've never been sanctioned by the West. They've never been sanctioned by the United Nations. They've never been called into court for their massive crimes. So all this goes on, and you got Mearsheimer, and he's talking about America, and he's talking about Russia, and he's talking about the EU, and he's mentioning Israel, yeah, Iran. But he's never talking about the fact. He also says one other point I'd like to make, and I'd like to get your weight in on this. So when he says it's a multipolar world, he's right. It is a multipolar world. But the Jewish entity of Meta, which is Facebook, the Jewish entity, which is in billion-dollar contracts with Israel and the absolutely highest security agency of Israel, which of course is the Mossad. Same thing with Google. Same thing with broadcast media. It reaches out from Hollywood all over the world and newspapers that are also reprinted all over the world. Even though it is a multipolar world, it's a multipolar world that has enormous influence by media and academia coming from this organized ethnocentric group that we call Jews, and which they themselves have organizations called like the Council of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, which are unanimously in their support for these wars, the genocide in Gaza, and everything else. So what's your comment on that first part?
All right, well, give me a couple minutes to talk about John Mearsheimer and his worldview, okay? So he's an international relations professor at the University of Chicago, and he is known as one of the major figures in the realist paradigm of international relations. And when I was studying international relations, I'd gotten a master's degree in the late 80s, got a PhD with a concentration in international relations in the early 90s. And at that time, he was a big deal. N not the only big deal, but he was somebody that we were reading. And what is realism? Because you hear people like Alexander Mackurris and others on the judges panel, and they just assume realism means being realistic. And realism doesn't have any connection with r reality any more than liberalism has a connection with liberty or communism has a connection with community. These are just names, okay? The realist school, and you could look other places, but Wikipedia's got a summary of it for these four propositions. States are the most important actors, and frankly, real realists. States are the only actors important enough really to consider. States, okay? So you don't look at what within the state. The system is at the international system is anarchic, so it rules and international
So
organizations
it's
don't
just
really
states.
matter.
By
It's
that,
just
does he mean, I
state
got a
power.
question, just a quick question for clarity. So he's just talking about the formal state itself, the institutions of that state,
Yes.
the guy who's the
Yes.
president or the head of the foreign policy, the State Department or the military of those states. So it's just the formal state that these policies are going to be made in the interest of. But what if a state
Yeah,
was
so
subverted?
you're not looking at, I mean, you would really wouldn't even be looking at lobby groups.
Right.
And then here's the this is really key here. This third one, states pursue their own narrow self-interest. States pursue their self-interest. Well, you look at the United States, and clearly these policies are not good. Not it's not just that they're not good for the population. But they're not good for the state. State power is being eroded by what we're doing. And John Mearsheimer was on a show with Glenn Diesing a couple of years ago, and Glenn Diesing, who is an international relations professor himself, asked John Mearsheimer how, given realism, how is it that the United States is pursuing these policies that are undermining its own state power? And John Mearsheimer very honestly said, "I don't have an answer for that." Because it's
How can he
you
not?
cannot
He's from the
have
University of Chicago. I mean, this is
you can
where
well
neoconism. Well, let me make a comment, and I want you to continue
okay
on. I'm letting you speak fully. I want you to be fully express yourself. But he's from the University of Chicago, right? This is where we had the creation of what's called modern neoconservatism, which were completely founded by former Jewish Bolsheviks, communists. Who decided that, well, they already had the left that they pretty much control, like the Schumers of the world, Democratic Party and leftists, because they were, traditionally leftist and pro-communist and pro-Russia when it was controlled by Jewish communists. In fact, back then, Russia got a favored nation status. It only became an enemy when Russian Christians took back over their government. That's something that we should put in our historical hat and keep it in our mind for a while. But here's these guys, and the entire leadership of neocons were all done by Russian, formerly communist Jews that realized that communism was not going to be taken over America, at least in its overt form. But they needed to find a way to influence their biggest opposition in the Congress, the traditional nationalist, not empire builders, but America firsters, people that were like the George Washington mode of American history, that they were against foreign entanglements, so they were against getting involved in foreign wars, that they were going to put America first. And they knew that if just supporting or just controlling the Democrat liberals, when some of them might be not even that sure of their positions, they knew that they had to find a way to control the Republicans. So overnight, they magically became Republican conservatives. And they started endorsing things like Open Borders. That was the Gang of Eight, for instance. That was later on. They took over National Review with Goldberg, I think his name, the top editor. And they produced this Jewish ethno-Zionist, you know, bullshit, anti-American stuff. And they led us into wars such as Iraq, which has ultimately cost us $8 trillion. And he knows this was a war that's cost us $8 trillion. He's talked about the cost of the war, but he's never talked about the fact explicitly that this was a Jewish war, that this was a war that was produced by the Jewish infiltration of the American government, American policy. It wasn't America. It wasn't the interest of the American people. It wasn't the state interest of America to get in the Iraq war that cost us 7,000 lives of our good, young, courageous men. It cost us millions of probably families that broke up and marriages that broke up. It cost us tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, wounded and damaged in this horrific war for Israel rather than America. And yet he still wants to pretend, talking about American interests or whatever, European interests, same thing with Europe. What has Europe got out of this anti-Russian policy? They've destroyed their own industry, their own businesses. They got their own type pipeline, which Europeans paid to build in conjunction with Russia, being blown up by the Jews that control America, right? It's just amazing, the hypocrisy and the you know, it's like, how can the man not be aware of these things and say these things? It all makes me feel like, in a way, he's in a sense, maybe it's just ideologically, but in some ways, controlled opposition.
Well, I wouldn't say he's controlled opposition. What I would say
to
is
a degree of
been,
it anyway.
He has. Well, it might seem as if it is, but he has an ideological and career history commitment to this school of thought, which, for like I say, for most people outside of academia, it doesn't mean anything. It just has kind of a nice, the name of it has a nice ring, realism. Oh, we should all deal with reality. It just sounds nice, but it means something, and there's tons of academic careers that revolve around debating, you know, realism versus liberalism versus complex interdependence, these various paradigms, globalism.
Right.
And he's often referred to as, you know, the dean of the realist school. So it's not just he's any professor. He's somebody who is at the forefront of promoting a particular explanation of world politics, world affairs. And this is a big deal. That's a career. This is his entire career. And the fact of the matter is, let me just revisit this.
Please, go ahead. And we'll get some more points to do. Go ahead.
These key propositions, states are the most important actor, and really in realism, they're the only ones worthy considering, and states pursue their self-interest.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
Here we have a situation where, I mean, I say, and I know you agree, that Jewish power is the most important aspect of world politics. You cannot understand world politics without dealing with Jewish power any more than you can explain physics without dealing with gravity. It is central to it, and it falls outside of the realist explanation of how things go on. But because Jews, for the most part, have not had a state. Finally, in 1948, they got a state, but Israel's not even really the home of Jewish power. So you've got massive Jewish power in America. And it there's not a place for it in the realist school of thought. There's not a place for the idea that you would have a domestic group, in this case, an ethnic minority, that could gain control of the state and that would run the state not in the best interest of the state that they control, but in the best interest of
their tribe,
group, which goes
their holy seed.
Their tribe. In the best interest of their get the most value out of that state for their tribe that goes across borders, even if it means
exactly
destroying the state. And they've destroyed states. They've gotten control of states and destroyed them along the way.
So let's
look at
let's dive in a little bit.
In 1990 Russia.
Thank you for that analysis. It's very good. And let's just
it's very
let's,
good.
Let's do a hypothesis between
Excellent.
two academics. So I would suggest that realism is a lie if you believe it's based on the idea that each state, each formal state, is dedicated to its own interest today. And he's constantly talks about the multipolar world we have now compared to the American hegemony that existed before. We do have more of a multipolar world, but we cannot forget the fact that views themselves are multipolar. Their influence extends all over the world because the mass media that they control, the mass publishing they control. In fact, I'm going to play a little essay that I just did, you know, a couple of days ago with a lecture. And I hope it works right. If it doesn't, we'll just continue to talk about other things. But the truth is that this multipolar world is also has tremendous influence from the Jews, because even in Pakistan, which would be slated more toward that multipolar world, the new world of BRICS, are same thing with India, same thing with Brazil, same thing with these other countries. There's still a lot of Jewish propaganda and Jewish lies that filter through. They're still, for their news, they're still half of the things they have in their own papers around the world are written by Jewish scribes in Jewish newspapers around the world, rather than even their own people. So they also have an impact in the so-called multipolar world. And to ignore this factor is just absolutely crazy to think about. So the realist position is a lie. I propose an hypothesis. Let me see if we can come to an agreement or differences on this. So I have an hypothesis that realism is not what this is about. This is about Jewish power. It's about Jewish hegemony. That's the conflict in the world. It's about Jews exerting their power and their interest over the best interests of America, over Europe, over Russia, over the world, over the Middle East, over the Third World, even over countries like China, which they see as competitors to their power because their roots of power are mainly in, you know, the United States and the EU, which is their traditional basis, and the military might that they wield by controlling us is through those. So maybe the real issue is not realism or state power being dedicated to the people of those countries, but maybe the real realism is Jews versus the world. What do you think? Jews versus humanity.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the reality.
It is reality, but it's fundamentally true, I think. Well, I don't know, it's my hypothesis that's what the world's really revolved. Let me finish. Let me explain myself before you go further. Listen, when I say this, what I'm saying is that the whole bipolar system, or multipolar system is what we should say, the multipolar system is a reaction to the Jewish domination of the former unipolar world by the Jews. That ultimately, that's exactly what it is. It is their reaction, because they might not know who rules it. They might think it's America's a major player, or Russia's a major player, or whatever, or in a bipolar world. But this, it's really what they're really dealing with. The reason why they've been facing this oppression, this economic absolute extortion by the economic devastation and these wars, is because of Jewish power. That's been the ultimate reason for it. It hasn't been state ideology. What do you think of that thesis?
No, I mean, I agree with your outlook. And in your outlook, it's centered on Jewish power. And, you know, maybe you and I might seem to overemphasize Jewish power. But really, I mean, there's such an underemphasis of it, and it is the Tyrannosaurus Rex in the room. And so, you know, our fixation on it, there's a reason for our fixation.
Let's play some more of the interview,
but
go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. And
continue,
you know,
if you have another comment.
This term realism, it's only been around since the mid-20th century. And the person
It's not
who's
realism,
really
it's Jewish
associated with,
supremacy is what's the biggest factor in the
well,
world. People that support Jewish supremacy are who they've bargained with or who they've arranged as their allies in it, and those who oppose Jewish supremacy. That's what really is going on in the world, in my opinion.
well, I mean, academics are always sitting around trying to figure out things and to take the very, very, very complex things that go on around us in nature, in human affairs,
Sure.
and boil it down to an essence. They try to boil it down to an essence. And realism is one way of trying to boil it down to a fundamental essence. And I'm not saying it's a lie or that the people who are associated with it, and in the early days, it was a lot of Jews, but there's a lot of Jews in academia.
Economic force because of oil and other reasons, and their regional influence, and Muslim is an effect even in politics around the world. And he talks about Asia, and he's right. That if you take China and you add into it today the rising India, and you take into that Asian prospect of, let's just take a look at Singapore. My God, what a power. Malaysia, all these other countries. And so when you take Asia, it's definitely the biggest concentration of power in the world. But then again, so why? They're not trying to conquer us with weapons or anything. They certainly want good trade, like every country would want to have. But instead of making peace with us, instead of having a war footing against them, it's in our interest not to have that kind of thing. Let's play some more with him. But again, you've noticed that he's not mentioned Jews one single time. He's even talking about the Middle East and the Gulf countries and all that. And he's not even mentioning the center of all this, which is Israel, yet he writes a book called The Israeli Lobby.
Highest level. But then, if you look at the Ukraine-Russia war and you look at the Iran war, what you see is that these two conflicts almost are guaranteed to never go away and to create a poisonous security environment in both Europe and in the Gulf. And why am I saying that? It's very important to understand, I think, that from Russia's point of view, the situation in Ukraine is an existential threat. From Ukraine's point of view, Russia is an existential threat. I fully understand why both actors in that conflict, Ukraine and Russia, view the other as an existential threat.
Now, again, no mention of Jews yet, but let's just take one position of this, and I'd like to get your take on it. And I'll offer my take and get your response, and whether you agree or disagree or whatever. But if you look at that, okay, the only reason that this conflict is going on, Russia was willing to join NATO. Russia wanted peace. All they asked for Ukraine, they actually Russia took out their missiles, they took out their war machine, they took down the Iron Curtain, and it was supposed to be a tit for tat thing where the Allies wouldn't try to expand anyway. The Jews who were controlling America, while Russia was trying to dislodge the Jews who controlled it, by the way, from communism. So here's Russia. They weren't the aggressor. The aggressor was not like Russia viewing Ukraine as an existential threat. This is an existential threat when you have people that hate you and say they hate you and they want to overthrow your country and divide it up into 13 different nations that they can easily exploit with the power of the United States. That's an existential threat. When they want nuclear missiles on their borders that could reach their capital in 5 minutes, that's an existential threat. The existential threat to Ukraine was manufactured because actually, Russia viewed Ukraine as fellow people of the Rus, fellow people of the Slavic people, and as partners in this. They just simply wanted peace between the two. And they didn't even object to Ukraine getting involved, having trade with Europe and doing all these other things. So the conflict from the Russian standpoint was because they were truly facing a threat. The real thing was initiated by the Jews that controlled the United States and therefore controlled NATO. That was the source, and yet it's not even mentioned. What's your comment there?
No, I mean, I agree with you, and I think his analyses are always coming up short. He is on the right side of most of the important issues, okay? And I do respect him for telling Glenn Deason that he had no explanation for in this case, I think it was the American support for Israel. I had
well, if he can't, he's like he's deaf, dumb, and blind, but, being at the University of Chicago. I mean, how can he not understand that, though? I don't understand.
Well, because he operates within this theoretical framework of realism, the international relations paradigm of realism. And if you have, that's his tool. And so, you know, it's like they say, if your only tool is a hammer, then the whole world looks like a nail. And I'm not trying to insult him, but
I don't want to insult him either, because I like the fact he stood up against the genocide in Gaza. But you can't to talk about world politics and not even mention Jews in relation to how the Middle East is being torn up. Everybody in the whole world knows that Jews are committing a genocide practically in the whole world. Everybody knows that Israel has been the source of more wars. They've been at war with seven countries in just the last few years, seven different countries, mass murdering people, civilians and others, schools and bridges and hospitals. And Iran has not been the rogue state. It's been Israel. I mean, the fact that he can't even mention the Jewish control, or not control, you say it right, the dominance they have over America, the control of American politics, and the control of American media, which, by the way, influences Europe greatly.
Yeah, and, you know, he wrote this book. Okay, so Hans Morgenthau is often thought of the father of realism. He was and he was a Jew from Germany who came to the United States in probably the 1940s or something. Kenneth Waltz was the father of structural realism, which was kind of a slight reworking of realism. But these were the really big names when I was in the 1980s, when I was studying international relations. These are the big names. Stephen Waltz's protege and his student teacher at Harvard was Stephen Walt, not Waltz, but Walt, no relation. But it was Stephen Walt who co-wrote this book on the Israel lobby with Mearsheimer back in the 2005. There was an article, I think 2006 was when the book was published.
I gotta play this now. But go ahead.
Okay, and you know the book itself is kind of not very typical realism, because it is looking at a domestic lobby, which typically they wouldn't be looking at. And that the last thing I'll say is it seems that even for a committed realist ideologue like Mearsheimer to completely ignore Jewish influence or Israeli domestic lobby influence was impossible, but it really doesn't fit in with realism.
Now, this is a lecture I did, and when you're using these other forms, and we have colleagues at the university and students, we have to put things without using my last name, so we often use a nickname, and so they often call me, you know, Professor Max or Max. But here it is. This is what I wrote. This is my essay, and it's also well documented. I think you're going to find it interesting. Here we go.
On Elite Hegemony, the Holy Seed, and the Crisis of Global Sovereignty, by Professor Max, PhD. The modern geopolitical landscape is often presented to the public through the sanitizing filters of corporate media as a series of disconnected tragedies. A border dispute in Ukraine, a security operation in Gaza, or preemptive strikes in Lebanon. However, as an academic committed to historical and literary critique, I contend that these are not isolated events. They are the visible tremors caused by a singular predatory force, a Tyrannosaurus Rex of elite power that dominates the Western apparatus. This hegemony is not merely political. It is rooted in a specific ethnocentric ideology of the Holy Seed, Zerukodesh, a messianic belief in a master race destined to preside over a humanity they deem a lower species. The theological roots of species-level racism. To understand the architects of current American foreign policy, one must examine the ideologies they revere. In the heart of the American executive branch, we find the overwhelming influence of the Lubavitcher movement and its late leader, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. To his followers, including Jared Kushner, who reportedly prayed at the Rebbe's grave before major political maneuvers, Schneerson is a messianic figure. Yet the Rebbe's own writings reveal a staggering racial hierarchy. He posits a fundamental difference not just in culture or belief, but on a species level. This is the height of racism, portraying 99.8% of the world's population as not even human beings, but animals who are inferior and possess evil souls, while claiming the Jewish people alone possess a holy soul. This ideology is the ultimate supremacist framework, justifying the enslavement and destruction of Gentiles while practicing strict endogamy and financial protectionism among their own. 1. It is a mocking irony that this holy seed mentality claims a monopoly on spiritual purity, yet its historical fruits include figures who have brought nothing but destruction. Where was the holiness in Karl Marx, the atheist who birthed a system that slaughtered millions? Where was it in Leo Trotsky, the architect of the Red Terror that decimated Christian Russia? Or in modern figures like Jeffrey Epstein, whose holy soul was occupied with the systematic predation of the innocent? We must ask, if these are the holy souls, what does that say about the ideology itself? The Council on Foreign Relations and the War on Russia. The Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, stands as the high temple of this ideology in the secular world. Founded in 1921 by figures like Paul Warburg, it has consistently served as the bridge between international banking and the State Department. Its flagship journal, Foreign Affairs, acts as the drafting board for the destruction of sovereign nations. The current animosity toward Russia is a historical vendetta. After the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, a movement dominated by Jewish activists with messianic fervor, and the subsequent Yeltsin years where Jewish oligarchs stripped the nation's assets, Russia eventually reclaimed its sovereignty. The crime of the current Russian administration was the overthrow of these oligarchs. In response, the CFR has advocated for the dismemberment of Russia into 13 or more smaller, manageable entities. As Jeffrey Sachs, a courageous voice among academics, has noted, the same neoconservative clique that lied the United States into the Iraq War, costing over $8 trillion and millions of lives, is now driving the escalation in Ukraine. Sachs explicitly names the architects, Victoria Nuland, Antony Blinken, and Jake Sullivan. These individuals do not fear nuclear brinkmanship because their loyalty is not to the American people, but to a globalist hegemony that views a sovereign Russia as an obstacle to their rules-based order. The cost of hegemony, genocide in Gaza, Lebanon, and Iran. The consequences of this master race ideology are most visible in the carnage of the Middle East. Gaza and Lebanon. The onslaught has moved beyond defense into the realm of clear, biblical-style genocide. According to The Lancet and recent updates, the true death toll, including those buried under rubble and deaths from starvation, is estimated to exceed 186,000, with some projections reaching much higher. 8.1. This is an ethno-war enabled by American billions and shielded by a media landscape where Google, Meta, and the New York Times act as filters for Zionist interests. Negotiations with Iran. It is the height of insanity that the lead negotiators for the U.S., Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, are both radical Zionists who celebrate the Holy Seed ideology. 4.1. These men are not representing America. They are representing a tribal interest that seeks the strangling of the Iranian economy to achieve regime change. This is War for Israel by another name, a sacrifice of American blood and treasure for a tribalistic, messianic prediction of total dominance. The financial and information chokehold, this Tyrannosaurus Rex, sustains itself through a near monopoly on finance and information. Campaign finance. Billionaires like the Adelsons gave Donald Trump nearly $600 million to secure pro-Israel policies like the annexation of the Golan Heights. In the 2024 cycle, AI PAC spent hundreds of millions to ensure that no dissenting voice remains in Congress. The tech tentacles, Google, Alphabet, and Meta, Facebook, now control the vast majority of information flow on Earth. Led by individuals like Ruth Porat, these organizations act as censors, ensuring that any critique of the Holy Seed is labeled anti-Semitic and purged. The Federal Reserve. The architecture of the global economy remains in the hands of a group that has historically practiced usury against Gentiles while protecting its own interests. 7. Conclusion. A defense of humanity. We stand at a precipice. The Tyrannosaurus Rex in the room is devouring the peace of the world, from the steppes of Ukraine to the hospitals of Gaza. This tiny, ethnocentric elite, fueled by ancient, tribalistic, and genocidal interpretations of their own superiority, is leading humanity toward a third world war. If we love peace, if we value the freedom of Europeans, Russians, Iranians, and Palestinians alike, we must stand up to this threat. We must take our gloves off. We must reject the notion that any one group is a different species. with a divine right to rule over the animal-like Gentiles. It is time to reclaim our sovereignty from the think tanks of Washington and the boardrooms of the CFR. We must act now, or we will all be consumed by the messianic madness of a few who worship only their own genealogy. Endnotes. 1. Schneerson, Menachem Mendel, Likutei Amorim, Tanya, Chapter 1. The souls of the nations of the world, the Gentiles, however, derive from the other, impure kelipot, shells, which contain no good whatever. The souls of the nations of the world are of a completely different and inferior order. They are of the same species as the cattle and the beasts of the field. 1.1, 2.1, 2, Schneerson, Menachem Mendel. Gathering of conversations. The difference between a Jewish soul and a non-Jewish soul is so great that they should be considered completely different species. The Gentile soul is of an evil order. 10.1, 3, Sachs, Jeffrey D., The Neocons and the War in Ukraine. Jeffrey Sachs Blog, August 15, 2023. The people who brought us the Iraq War, the neoconservatives, Victoria Nuland, Anthony Blinken, and Joe Biden, are the same ones who have pushed for NATO expansion to the very border of Russia, ignoring every red line and provoking a war that has destroyed Ukraine. 5.1, 4, The Lancet. Counting the dead in Gaza, difficult but essential. Volume 404, July 2024, updated January 2025. It is not implausible to estimate that up to 186,000 or even more deaths could be attributable to the current conflict in Gaza, due to direct violence, hunger, and disease caused by the destruction of infrastructure. 8.1, 5, Brown University. Costs of War Project, March 12, 2026 update. The total cost of post-9/11 wars has reached $8 trillion, including direct spending and future veterans care. Recent regional operations in the Middle East have added billions more, even before a single shot was fired in the newest conflict. 7.1, 6, Brooks David. The Chosen Getting In, The New York Times, July 13, 2010. The Jewish takeover of America has been a quiet revolution. As one woman described it, "You're talking about the Jewish takeover of America, truly," referring to the displacement of the old WASP establishment by a new and predominantly Jewish elite. 7. The Torah / Old Testament. Deuteronomy, chapter 23, verse 20. Unto a stranger, Gentile, thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother, Jew, thou shalt not lend upon usury, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all that thou settest thine hand to in the land whither thou goest to possess it. 8. Mearsheimer, John J. and Walt, Stephen M. The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. 2007. The lobby's influence has been consistently pro-Israel, pushing the United States into conflicts that are not in its national interest, and maintaining a stranglehold on congressional discourse regarding the Middle East. 9. Arms Control Association. U.S. negotiators were ill-prepared for serious nuclear negotiations with Iran, March 11, 2026. U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner's lack of knowledge and mischaracterization of Iran's positions likely informed Trump's assessment that talks were not progressing. 4.1. Bibliography, Chicago Style. Adelson, Miriam. Campaign Finance Reports and Influence. Washington, D.C. FEC Archive, 2025. Brooks, David. The Chosen Getting In, The New York Times, July 13, 2010. Brown University. Costs of War Project, The Iraq Conflict. Providence, Watson Institute, 2026. Mearsheimer, John Jay, and Stephen M. Walt. The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. New York, Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, 2007. Sachs, Jeffrey D. The Neocons in the Ukraine War. Jeffrey Sachs Blog, 2023. Schneerson, Menachem Mendel, Likutei Amorim, Tanya. Brooklyn, Kehat Publication Society, 1973. The Lancet, Counting the Dead in Gaza. Difficult, but essential. The Lancet 404, number 10,449, July 2024, 237 to 238. Menachem Mendel, Likutei Amorim.
I won't play all the footnotes. But anyway, what do you think of that, Doctor, and how do you like it?
I had my mute on. I was just saying, I think that Professor Max guy is really smart. You should try to get him on the show.
When I do some of these things in terms of what we put in print, it's like the people at the university where I give this lecture, they know who I am. And in fact, I'm introduced as who I am. But when we do stuff in aspects of texts and so forth, we use a little bit of a pseudonym. It's a nickname that I've had since I was a kid. And that's why we use that. It also makes sure that when we have intersection with this or criticism of this, that they're dealing mainly with the issues promoted or issues talked about rather than the false personality the media's produced of me. And we can understand that false reality pretty well. But in terms of the classes, the students know exactly who I am, but it's pretty amazing. In Eastern Europe, there's a lot more freedom than there is here. And even it's not what we pointed out. If I did a big published thing under David Duke at these certain lectures, and we made a big deal of it, they would end up concentrating their power and trying to destroy that specific university. Just like the university I graduated from in Ukraine has really been taken over back by the Jewish state and the Zelenskys of the world. And I used to, they used to have an anti-Zionist World Congress. I was always often their keynote speaker. I wrote academic articles for their major magazine for the university. And so the university with 32,000 on-campus students, they have a huge campus of 200 acres and very top of a beautiful hill overlooking all of Kiev. I mean, it was an amazing thing. And these people were very pro-European. They are also pro-third world, too. I mean, they even had a school because a lot of people, Asians and Africans, they even had a school for Mandela. I might not agree with everything Mandela was. He was a black communist. But at the same time, I understand the surge for people to control societies where the vast majority. However, the vast majority should have never become the mass majority. It was because of the fact they had mass migration. And I understand why, because the people of Africa wanted to escape the tyrannies of the neighboring countries to South Africa. They wanted to enjoy the medical care. They wanted to enjoy the education. They wanted to enjoy the economic prosperity. They wanted to enjoy the relative freedom and the less lawlessness and so forth, murder, abuse, sexual attacks and so forth that went on in other parts of Africa. They came in. But the South African government would have had the right to preserve that issue. But some people, in fact, in terms of the economic aspect, because they still had a lot of Jews, unfortunately, in South Africa, and they were more than happy to have this transition because they felt they could control the workers in South Africa once they supported Mandela and they supported these were open communists, by the way, supporting them because they knew they could negotiate with them. If they controlled them, they could get the workers for nothing, whether it's in a more free society, workers, both black and white, would have been paid better wages. Any thoughts, sir?
No, I don't.
Well, I'm glad I'm doing so well that sometimes you're rendered speechless,
Yeah, it's 55 minutes after the hour.
That's all right. I can go to the top of the hour now because of the new way they structure it at the office. But go ahead.
Just to get back to, Mearsheimer and academia. Mearsheimer's on the right side of these issues, but his explanations come up short. You've got Jeffrey Sachs, who actually... he's not from an international relations school. He's from an economic school. But, the main rival to realism, when I was studying, there was the three schools of thought were realism, liberalism, which had its own meaning. It didn't mean Black Lives Matter or anything like that. And Marxism. These were like the three paradigms of international relations. And even though Sachs doesn't come out of an international relations school, he really represents kind of the liberal view, and I'm not talking about like Black Lives Matter, American domestic politics liberal, but in international relations, and which emphasizes cooperation between nations, and it's not all about power, military power. It's also about economics and things like that. And yet they agree on most issues. On most of these current issues, they actually agree. But they actually have very, very different perspectives. And you do see it when they're talking about China. You do see a big difference because Jeffrey Sachs, sees China as a potential cooperator
Right, we're just about out of time, but let me pose one more question. It's often said, if you want to know who rules over you, find out whom you can't criticize. And the fact that he can't even come out directly, even Jeffrey Sachs can't. He mentions all these Jews that shaped the whole Ukraine policy, which has killed at least 1.5 to 2 million Ukrainians, some of the best of Ukraine. They killed both Slavic Ukrainians and Slavic Russians, you know, by a couple million now. And it's insane. And these have been traditional enemies of the Jews. They're happy to do it. So one way you can kind of learn who controls you, who you can't criticize, and think of this. The worst thing that the media, the same Jewish media of the world says, is the worst thing is to be a racist. If any state in Europe or the United States or any other nation in the world, especially in the West, made it a law that you could not marry a Jew, that you discriminated against marrying a Jew, if any state did that, they would be sanctioned. They would practically declare war against them. And yet the only state in the world that has a state like this of the Western world is Israel, which forbids the marriage of a Jew to a non-Jew. And it's very encompassing. And they control the immigration to limit only to Jews. So this is amazing. And if it was all these different people that were doing this control, and if it was not a Jewish issue, then why in the world would they let Israel be that way and yet not let people, the Gentiles, which have influence in media and government or business or whatever, that they can't preserve their people, but the Jews can preserve theirs? That is a tell about who runs things. Thanks for being with me, Doctor. I appreciate you very, very much. Okay, folks, that's it. See you on Monday. Bye-bye now. Please share this with your friends, hrradio.net. That's www.hrradio.net, and send us a contribution, if you can, at Box 188, Mandeville, Louisiana, 70470. Love you, and I'll see you again on Monday. Bye-bye.